Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Wednesday, May the 28th. This time I'm going to open up as a subcommittee for the purpose of taking information on Senate Bill 5526.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while we're waiting for quorum, I would recommend that Commissioner Gardner give the committee an overview of his revised budget plan, which we did not have an opportunity to discuss during the public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And actually, I have a couple of handouts I can... budget note and the other on the revised budget plan. In the governor's recommended budget, which came out last December, it called for a 10% reduction in the Bureau of Labor and Industries. At the time, then Commissioner Roberts made several recommendations contained within that budget. After taking office on January the 6th, what we basically did was went back and revisited those reductions and found a few different ways to accomplish the same 10% reduction, but by accomplishing a couple of different things. First was trying to, my philosophy basically was that I'd rather reduce infrastructure than people. If you look at the history of the Bureau of Labor and Industries and its reduction in staff, and there are actually a couple of handouts and charts contained within your folder that actually do show the reduction in staff over a period of years with the Bureau, showing that basically back in 1995 when Commissioner Roberts took office, there were 159 employees within the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The governor's recommended budget called for 102. I think more so than any other state agency out there, the Bureau of Labor and Industries has made those types of reductions. So in the 10% realignment, what we did was saved 4.125 FTE in the 03-05 biennium while still cutting 6.75 FTE in 03-05. What we also did, Commissioner Roberts had called for the closure of the Medford office, and that would only leave us full-service offices in Portland, Salem, and Eugene. I really felt that there needed to be a presence in Southern Oregon. So in the realignment, we keep actually 4 out of the 6 employees within the Medford office, keeping a full-service office open in the Medford area. Now, this is accomplished through a series of different things. First is reduction in overhead in both Salem, Medford, and Portland. What we did in Salem is we are looking at reducing that office down to our farm labor unit and moving it into the Woodburn area, where actually there is a lot more agriculture and it's a more centrally located base. But it would greatly reduce our rent cost from what it is right now in the Lancaster Road facility. With Medford, we do the same thing, actually reduce by almost two-thirds the rent within the Medford office by moving it in with the Family Center, which is a county facility down in the Medford area. And actually, that particular facility, there's been a few articles in the Medford paper because it actually would keep the Family Center open. They are running out of money without having tenants such as the Bureau of Labor and Industries. They can't afford to stay open as well. So it's a good match for the community and keeps a full-service office in Southern Oregon in the Medford area. Also, other reductions we're looking at are in the Portland office. One of the things I discovered, having taken office just under 5 months ago in my vast experience so far, is that there are actually 4 reception areas within the Portland office. There's one for the commissioner's office, for the wage and hour division, the apprenticeship division, and the civil rights division. And we have all of the 10th floor and a quarter of the 11th floor of the Portland building in the Lloyd Center District in Portland, which it does make it a commute for me every day to come here. But anyway, by reducing that down to one common reception area and doing a small remodel, we believe we can do, we can get most, if not all, of the 11th floor space that we're using down onto the 10th floor, make it more customer friendly in that it's easier for people who come into the Bureau to come in. And actually, our goal is to accomplish this within the next few months, is to realign staff so that we actually have receptionists in one common area, and rather than going into our telephone answering system, we're trying to get it to the point where live people actually answer the phone. I think if it, to me, that's extreme customer service. I don't particularly like getting answering machines when, you know, I call any business or any government agency, and I think that we can be able to do that by this reduction. And by the reduction of those common spaces of reception areas, we can put in more cubicles, getting more people actually down onto the 10th floor. And the health department has indicated that they would be more than willing to pick up the additional part of our lease in that area. So even with a small cost of a remodel, we would see extreme savings out of doing so. We've done other things such as reduced our cars. We've gotten rid of one of the cars in Medford office, one in Salem, and actually got rid of the commissioner's car. So so we're actually finding cost savings in a number of areas. Also, one of the other realignments show that we have never through the Bureau actually aligned some of our administrative costs to some of the funds that we serve. For instance, we have the Wage Security Fund and the Prevailing Wage Fund. Christy Hammond, who is the head of the Wage and Hour Division, none of her time, although she spends a great deal of it on prevailing wage issues, is allotted into that fund. A great deal of my time spent on those issues, and the deputy, Annette Talbot's, and others, as far as computer services, as far as our payroll, etc. And by doing some of those cost shifts, aligning the actual costs with the funds that they serve, we were able to realign about another $316,000 and consolidate you know, some of the programs and some of the staff and some of those rent costs and infrastructures I mentioned. And by doing that, we were able to save more FTE in order and keep a full service office open in the Medford area. Basically, that is the nuts and bolts of the realignment package and how we accomplished that 10% reduction.
Thank you. You know, this has been one of the interesting things to be on a Ways and Means Committee, you know, not only here but in the afternoon, and find out how many people are coming back saying, listen, we can deliver the services and we'll do it with less money. And I'm going to tell you, on behalf of the taxpayers of Oregon, we appreciate it, you know, that because it's just showing everybody is making it work. And sounds a little preachy. Sorry about that. Any questions about the new plan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to continue on with further testimony? Okay. I really wanted to talk just for a few minutes about our hearing last Friday, where we had approximately 35 people testify in favor of the program and three in opposition, including former Commissioner Roberts, who clearly pointed out, you know, the reductions that have been made over the last several years, and his support as well for apprenticeship and training programs. I think the thing to remember about apprenticeship and training is that it is economic development. Actually, if you look back in the records, as we have, it actually was funded out of economic development dollars a number of years ago. It also is, we talk about education. I mean, I've served here, as all of you have, and education, we talk about that being number one. I think that clearly that we complement the education system and are not in competition with the K through 12 or the community college system, but we complement that as well. And I think it, you know, what the return on the investment of the dollars of apprenticeship program is tremendous. You get a 5-to-1 match, for instance, out of federal and state taxes that are paid by the apprentices that go through that program compared to the dollars that are spent. You also heard about, from all the private programs, about all the dollars that they spend that are not state dollars. There are clearly millions of dollars spent on apprenticeship and training, and a strong commitment by business, by labor, and by the apprentices who testified about our programs and about the quality of those programs and our oversight of it. I think that if Commissioner Roberts were here, he could tell you of his experiences with the federal government. I think that really is at the crux of the debate, is can the federal government take over these programs? They have one person assigned to the entire state who lives in the state of Washington and has an office in Oregon. And as of the 6th of next month, I'll be in office 5 months, and I have yet to see him or have one phone call. I met with his supervisor from the Seattle area once and actually asked for a letter from him about an exception I wanted for a program. I have yet to receive that, and that was 3 months ago. The federal government is experiencing the same cutbacks that we are. The Department of Labor is experiencing the largest cutbacks of all departments within the federal government, and apprenticeship through the Department of Labor will experience their cuts as well. I don't see where there will be the staff or the oversight for this or where the federal government could step in. There is no clear indication whatsoever that they could. And it's also clear that I believe even if they were to oversee it, that the standards would not be the same. We have clear Oregon standards within apprenticeship through the Apprenticeship and Training Committee through what's been developed for a number of years. And I think that those standards have graduated quality apprentices, and they need to continue to do so. The one thing to remember also is that the three people who testified against the apprenticeship were all from the same committee. It's a low-voltage field, and most of what they testified against, such as the paperwork, etc., are all federal requirements. They would not go away. There was a question Representative Hansen asked about how much community colleges spend, and that is in excess of $5 million on apprenticeship, according to the figures, over twice what the cost of the Bureau of Labor and Industries is. Senator Dukes asked about a budget note on women in apprenticeship. That is one of the things that was handed out to you.
I actually didn't distribute that.
Oh.
My recommendation would be that we not get into a discussion of the budget note until we know whether or not apprenticeship and training is actually going to survive.
Well, there's a budget note there in case. Anyway, we talked about the 10% reduction. Let me point out a few of the things that are contained within your packet. On the left-hand side, you will find more information on apprenticeship, the advantages of it, and the return on public expenditure, where you can see that, you know, some of the figures of well over 5-to-1 return on the investment, where you can also see that we predate the federal apprenticeship program. Oregon has been doing apprenticeship Oregon's way for a number of years and doing it quite well. There's also some questions about specific economic and technical assistance benefits of having a state-run program, and also some coordination with state and local government programs as well. And contained within their answers several of the questions that have been asked of apprenticeship training. There's also a couple of charts in there. If you look at this one in particular, I don't have them numbered, so I don't think they're numbered in your packet. But this shows where statewide the number of FTE over the last several biennia has increased, and yet the number of FTE with the Bureau of Labor and Industries has dramatically decreased. The Bureau of Labor and Industries has been one of the most efficient state agencies out there under Commissioner Roberts. And also, the next chart shows from 93 to 95 adjusted to 2005. If we had maintained and kept up with the just in that time frame, dollars for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we would be here asking for over $31 million instead of the 20 included in that chart. It also shows, you know, some of the general fund appropriations in the third chart, where it shows that we've been flat, where general fund appropriations for and lottery fund appropriations have dramatically increased over the last several biennia on the third chart there. Let's see. On the right-hand side of your packet, it shows that there is a description and figures on the various different funds that we do oversee, from the Wage Security Fund to the Prevailing Wage Fund to the Technical Assistance to Employers Unit, which actually is a self-sustaining unit. That one chart, you know, goes throughout the state putting on seminars for businesses. Our belief has always been that the best way to enforce the law is through education and prevention of any violations in the first place, and that's what that unit's created for, is to put on those technical seminars for employers, to create booklets that make it easier for employers to understand the law, and that answer thousands of phone calls every single year to employers to help them when they do have problems. Usually when they call us, it's generally an immediate problem facing them, and we need to give them an immediate, accurate answer, and that unit is absolutely marvelous at it. There's also the, you know, the Injured Workers Fund and our OSHA contracts, our farm labor, farm and forest labor contracting, and some of the CRD. But there's all sorts of information in there about those various funds. I don't know, I guess I can't emphasize to you enough how strongly I personally feel about the Apprenticeship and Training Division as a graduate of Apprenticeship and Training, as one who's seen Apprenticeship and Training in other states. You heard one of the people here testify on Friday, and I was actually surprised by his testimony. He was talking about how he had gone through an apprenticeship in a different state. Well, you'll find that I'm actually in the same category, and I actually went through an apprenticeship program about 50 miles from where he did, but wasn't aware that he did. And I can tell you the difference in apprenticeship from one state to another, and Oregon does do it best. They do it right, and I think in keeping our Apprenticeship and Training Division, we can continue to do that. In these economic times, I think the best thing we can do is not do things to further decrease or decline the economy. And I think that in, you know, removing our authority for apprenticeship and training, we would be adding to it, not helping to get us out of the economic times that we're in. And I think with that, I'll leave it to your questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. At this time, let me go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 5526. We now have a quorum.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to start?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before I start on the LFO recommendations, I wanted to point out that I have organized this recommendations in such a way that we can work this budget up to the point of the co-chair's recommendations, and then put it on the shelf until such time as we get a decision or a change in the decision about the apprenticeship and training program. So it's structured in that way. My first recommendation is to ask for a motion that the Bureau of Labor and Industries will develop performance measures in accordance with the direction established by the Labor Commissioner and will review these measures with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee by no later than September of 2004. If you recall, during the public hearing, there was testimony that the commissioner was not comfortable with the performance measures that had been established under the prior administration and wanted the opportunity to revise those performance measures.
Any questions?
Would you like a motion?
If there's no questions, that would be great. Okay. The motion is that we accept the performance measure revision. And is there any further discussion about that? If not, we will do it without objection.
The second recommendation is that the committee move to approve the Labor Commissioner's revised budget plan as he has just discussed. The details are outlined at my page 2 of 17, which is the summary of the BOLI budget. As the commissioner noted, these adjustments do not include any adjustments that would be associated with the apprenticeship and training.
Okay, Robin, do they include the adjustments that Commissioner Gardner described?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, it includes all of the changes that the commissioner described, except for anything related to apprenticeship and training, which their plan footnotes.
Mr. Chairman.
So moved.
Where are you going?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
nobody had any comments.
So I thought, so move the motion.
Oh, I thought you said I moved. So.
Well, we've dealt with the comments thing without objection. It's easy today. So,
Mr. Chairman, you need any space of time for me, and I will use it.
I will not get up and try to warm it up.
That's right.
My next recommendation is a motion that the subcommittee approve the budget adjustments as detailed in items 1 through 5.
Okay. Page 2. Mm-hmm. Any questions on that one?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dukes.
If you have already gone through this, don't take any extra time.
No, we did not.
Okay, because I was going to say, I was down getting a bill out of committee, but the vacant position, the one position that has no sustainable funding source, I was curious as to what that position did.
My recollection is it was an other funds position that was never funded. It was approved in the last biennium as a position if the other funds became available, which they never did, and it never got filled.
Okay, thank you. Take care of that.
Okay. Any further questions? Do we have a motion to approve the following budget adjustments that are listed as 1 through 5?
So moved.
Okay. It's been moved that we accept the budget adjustments listed 1 through 5 on page 2. Is there any further question or discussion relative to that? Then without objection, so moved.
And, Mr. Chair, I believe that that takes care of everything that we can do on this budget at this time.
Okay. Well, the committee seems to be very happy. Thank you for your presentation. And thank everyone that came in on Friday. I thought that was very informative for all of us, and I really appreciated the attitude that everybody had. Because, you know, there was some expectation that might be a little hostile, but it was very pleasant. So many of you had to leave. I was here with them by myself and felt perfectly secure. So, in fact, we had a lot of fun when you guys were all gone.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. There's been some discussion, and I wondered if you could maybe elaborate, Dan, on the status of the, apparently there's some interpretation of the codes by the feds that we're not providing access to treatment, or not treatment. I've got my hospital access for training. And that there is some review on by the federal government. I wonder if you could elaborate on.
Oh, certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris. I believe what you're referring to is what's called the needs test. And the federal government, basically, the federal government right now is reviewing California. They're actually in court with the state of California over their needs test, and we have one as well. There was one apprenticeship program denied well over a year ago, about a year and a half, like almost 2 years ago now, in the Salem area based on the needs test. And let me explain what the needs test is. Is that what the needs test simply says is that if there's a pre-existing apprenticeship program in an area, that before you can start the same apprenticeship program, a different in the same craft, that what you need to do is talk to that apprenticeship program and see if you can do the training together. To give you an example, in Oregon we have 77 union programs, 63 non-union programs, and 28 combined programs. There are 28 of them that work together and do very, very well. And so what you're saying is if you have a pre-existing program, whether it be union or non-union, and you have one, I mean, that's usually what it ends up being, so and you have one that wants to start up, whether it's union or non-union, they have to talk to the other side and see if they can train together. This particular program was a Mason's program, and actually Commissioner Roberts would have probably been a better one to ask than me since it happened under his administration, but I understand that they basically refused to go and talk to the other side, demanded their own program, and the apprenticeship and training committee has, you know, used the needs test and refused to set up the program. I have talked to the same people and encouraged them on a number of occasions to apply again for that particular program. To this date, they have not done so, and in the 5 months I've been commissioner, there has been one apprenticeship program that has applied for acceptance, and it has been accepted and started as a program. I don't, you know, we have the needs test. There is a court case going on in California right now over it, and there is, we'll see how that turns out and decide what to do with that, you know, particular requirement from there.
Is there anyone that's denied access to a training program?
Is there, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if I might inquire, do you mean is there any particular individual denied or any program denied starting? If you could clarify a question.
If I wanted to, excuse me,
yes.
If I wanted to enroll in the plumber's training, is there any restriction?
If you, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if you wished to apply for electrical, plumbing, any program, they have their own requirements within that individual joint apprenticeship training committee that you may need to qualify for. For instance, they may require a high school diploma. They may require you be 18 years of age. You meet those requirements, and there is no restriction whatsoever beyond that point of your entering that program. But the requirements are very minimal at best.
Are all of the trades programs open access?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, absolutely. If they weren't, we would be on them very, very heavily. There are EEOC standards to meet. And there is open enrollment in all of them as long as you meet the minimum criteria. As I said, for instance, that you be 18 years of age and have a high school diploma is some of the programs require it. Some of them require that you be within 6 months of graduation and 17 years of age. But as long as you meet those minimum requirements, there is no other barriers to anyone applying for those apprenticeship programs. When I actually entered the apprenticeship program too many years ago to remember, there was actually a requirement that you had to be under the age of 26 or you would get 1 year of credit for every year of military service. It might have been 25, but I think the oldest person in my class was at the time 27. There have been age discrimination suits since then, and there is no age requirement, for instance. There's many things that have changed over the years in case law to stop any barriers such as that.
Senator Carter?
Dan, can you tell me if there are any welding apprenticeship programs available now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, with me is Steve Sims, who is the head of the Apprenticeship and Training Division. There are, to my knowledge, no welding apprenticeship programs per se in actual welding. However, contained within many of the apprenticeship programs, such as electrical apprenticeship, as I went through, there is a component of welding within it. There certainly is in plumbing and steam fitting and many of the other crafts. Ironwork, etc. It is an element of those different crafts, but not an individual craft in and of itself.
I guess I was asking that question because I'm trying to think of the steel company in North Portland in my district, Schnitzer. Was saying that they could use all the welders they could find. And I was wondering then maybe they would be a very appropriate industry to come and talk to you guys about setting something of that nature up of the college or something of that nature. Would that be an appropriate conduit? How does it work?
Perhaps I can let Steve answer the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, Steve Sims, the Administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division. As Commissioner Gardner stated, what's happened over the years was welding at one time was a separate, identifiable, standalone trade. People identified themselves as welders. Welding has become so integral into so many industries now that very few people just want a welder. But it is still identified by the Department of Labor as a trade. So if Schnitzer Steel or anyone else wanted to start a standalone apprenticeship program in welding, we would certainly welcome that. There's certainly adequate support in the private training centers and also at the community colleges to support a program. So I would say have them give us a call, and we'd be happy to help them out.
Yeah, a question I had about the age restriction on the low side is, you know, since we have had, and we talked about this in the committee and with you folks, as we've had the elimination of all of the industrial arts type of training that was in the high school, I mean, it's just about uniform across the board down the state. Is there any effort, and I think you guys articulated it, to reach back into the high schools, get a person set on the idea of a trade as a good way to make a living, and get them started early.
Well, Mr. Chair, there are a number of programs out there to do that. Actually, two programs we've talked about instituting, and we've actually talked with Superintendent Castillo about doing. We're looking for the potential of finding some Perkins grant dollars, et cetera, to accomplish two different things on apprenticeship. One is that I believe through the just as if you're in a licensed craft like electrical or plumbing and you do continuing education, teachers do continuing education for their teaching certificate. And I believe that one of the disconnects that we've found over a number of years is that guidance counselors and a lot of the math and science teachers don't really know as much about apprenticeship as they should. Consequently, I talk to many of the apprenticeship programs, and what they feel is that guidance counselors will recommend the child who's been through the local juvenile justice authority for apprenticeship rather than the student who may be very, very bright. There's such a push to go to four-year college. And there are many young people who they're just not geared toward a four-year college. They're more geared toward doing something with their hands in a skilled profession. And what we would like to do is get certification, and part of this is going to be doing some realignment through apprenticeship in actually reducing some of the paperwork that you heard some people complain about on Friday. By doing so, being able to free up staff to help to be a partner with the schools and with the programs to actually set up a seminar for continuing education for those teaching certificates to bring them into apprenticeship and training facilities and let them show them the math, the science, the skills that are in there, the computer skills. I mean, if any of you have not been through some of the state-of-the-art facilities that are out there, I'd highly encourage you to, and I'd be happy to set up a tour of a couple of the best ones are certainly UA290 in Tualatin or IBEW Local 48 near Airport Way in Portland. You have multi-million-dollar facilities with computer labs, with testing labs, with, you know, millions of dollars worth of electronic equipment, and the technical skills applied to it you would not believe. And I think what we'd like to do is bring in a lot of those teachers through continuing education and show them what apprenticeship is all about, how much math, how much science, and what a good profession it is, high paid with decent wages and decent benefits. The second thing we'd like to do, if we can find federal funds, is we do have 54 different training facilities throughout the state. With 188 apprenticeship, joint apprenticeship, and training programs. These facilities, for the most part, are not used during the day. And as you talked about, Mr. Chair, the shop classes in most of the high schools out there is being reduced, if not totally cut and gone. And it doesn't give that extra skill, that extra help in the beginning to gear a young person toward that apprenticeship. And what we'd like to do is set up perhaps a pilot program, one rural and one urban, to get it started and use the electrical training facilities, the apprenticeship training facilities. Too much electrical in my life, I'm sorry. But use the apprenticeship training facilities that are out there and actually bring in students, you know, in those two pilot programs who would be the students more geared toward that type of a career to give them the hands-on training and that taste of apprenticeship from the very beginning.
See, that's my thought exactly, because we have worked over the last few years, to make sure that a student that wants to go to the community college or wherever and access additional training, that we freed them up to do that with approval of their local school administration. And so, it's just a natural not to lose a track that would go back to the student and say, you may want to think about this as a career. Because you're right, in some of the career fairs, the trades are not mentioned. These are good paying jobs. And so many times they're just not mentioned as something you want to do, because you're right, the direction is for university and then some other type of employment. But you and I both know that this system won't work. For example, yesterday, what happens when a main breaks? Somebody better. All the capital shuts down and we all leave the building. And
Mr. Chair, I can guarantee you the same thing would happen if the substation blew, and you lost the electricity. You're absolutely right, and there are a number of students geared toward that, and that's the direction I'd like to see apprenticeship and training go in this state with the Apprenticeship and Training Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and to also work toward more diversity within those crafts, to see that we're a partner in helping to bring up the numbers of women and minorities, to see that there is equal access all the way through, and that we are attracting more in those programs as well. Those are all three different, training of teachers to be our advocates for apprenticeship, to get more shop classes towards students, even in a different way if that's what we have to do, and to see that we have more diversity are all three key components and key directions I want to see apprenticeship and training go to over my tenure as commissioner, provided I still have an apprenticeship and training division, Mr. Chair.
Would you assure the two folks to my right here that after they had to leave, that I continue to ask questions about women and minority in training? Would you tell them that?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I'll back you up 100%, whatever he said. Actually, all kidding aside, Mr. Chair, you did actually continue to ask those questions.
Well, you were leaving me out on a limb. I was kidding.
Only kidding.
Just kind of a brief editorial comment. This morning in the Oregonian, I read the obituary of Jim Harder, who passed away a couple days ago, and he was president and owner of Harder Mechanical. It's on ML King, and it was one of the shops I served part of my apprenticeship with. And an incredible story. Graduate of Roosevelt High School, relatively modest plumbing shop that he took into making it one of the most successful mechanical contractors in the nation. And at one point it was like the 60th largest mechanical in the nation, and they did jobs all over the western states. They owned Thompson Steel Fab, an incredible economic engine. One of the things that drove that shop and his management philosophy was the fact that the workers that he had, particularly his foremen, were just incredible mechanics. His management style, or that company's management style, was to bid a job, get the job, hand the blueprints and a stack of purchase orders to the foreman, and say, "We'll see you in 12 months or whatever." They just, "Here's the stuff, go do the job." And like I say, incredibly, but it was based on the fact that they could get incredibly good foremen. And these are people that were going out and managing $10, $15 million jobs, which takes, you know, a lot of times our vision of a tradesperson is somebody driving a little service truck and putting pipe together. But the people that made that company were people that had a lot of hard science in high school, geometry, physics, chemistry, had management skills that they had picked up working with, being specifically trained through the apprenticeship, not just to put pipe together, but to actually run jobs and order things. And of course, the blueprint reading, the scheduling, all of those things are incredibly complicated. And if you've got that type of a workforce, you can send them all over the western states, and you can make, and it becomes, they created a real economic engine for the state. But it was based on having real good people that could work, and then he was a master at getting the maximum out of them in terms of letting them supervise, run, do things. Anyway, that I was thinking as I was reading that and reading the incredible success story that he was able to accomplish in his life. That's really, a lot of his success was based on a real strong apprenticeship program, and it's over a long term. But this is real important for economics. And as Commissioner Gardner was saying, in terms of the linkage with high school, now we've got a lot of guidance counselors. When I was Multnomah County Commissioner, I had our head of our juvenile justice department wanted to involve, we were building a new detention facility, and he wanted to involve his kids that were at the program in the construction of it, at which point, besides the fact that some of them shouldn't really be working with sharp instruments, just the concept of this is it takes a certain level of maturity. You're working in a very dangerous environment in terms of watching out for your other workers. You're moving heavy things, complicated equipment, and then there's a lot of self-discipline that's involved. And I don't know how appropriate it is in terms of you want a pretty mature workforce of people that are really safety-oriented, safety-conscious, and have had training and stuff to protect themselves and protect the other people that they have to work with. But the people we really need to recruit into the trade are the young people that are taking geometry, that have a basic understanding of physics and a basic understanding of chemistry, because that's what the world's all about. And when you're putting materials together, you have to know those things. And it'll be real important to get those kids that want to perceive that they want to be in the trades to start developing that background early. That it doesn't really help if you're 22 years old and you haven't had that kind of a background and then decide that you want to move in. They're really handicapped. But to get that kind of training early, and then also the kids that are perceived by the counselors and stuff as college bound because they're good at geometry and good in physics and stuff, to show them that there's another way that they can use these skills that also is going to be real productive. And anyway, it's a combination of things, but the heart of it comes back to the apprenticeship program, that it kind of is a way to develop some of the very finest of our workforce and people that are kind of the start of the high-tech industry. You can't get a high-tech industry if you don't have the people to build the buildings and put the equipment together. So anyway, end of my editorial comment, but this stuff is real important.
Well, I think all of us have experience of watching the student who, in fact, couldn't get any reason to understand math, but if you got them to calculate cam angles and cubic inches and stuff, all of a sudden they saw that there was a need for this. Same way with any of the other industrial arts type thing. All of a sudden, kids that didn't have much of an interest were industrial art drawing and stuff like that, and a career developed out of that. And that's been real frustration for me as I've watched Education Oregon lose so many of those things that I think really reaches backwards and grabs that child and says, that young person, and says, look, you can utilize the knowledge we're imparting to you for a real good career in the future. So I think that's necessary, and I'm frustrated by the fact that we're losing so much of that. That's why I'm bugging you about reaching backwards into the schools to see if we can set that kind of direction. Well, that's really way beyond our committee's jurisdiction. And is there anything further to come before the committee? If not, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 5526, and with a tap of the gavel, we'll be adjourned. Thank you. Oh, Senator Morris.
I have a question. I think it might be of interest to the entire committee. It doesn't have anything to do with bowling.
Tell me, Senator.
He's moving away from the mic very quickly.
For the information, by the way. Looking at our budget and the dilemma that we now have, there is what I call a cost savings effect, and it's the DOS reduction, AG reduction, inflation reduction, merit COLA reduction. And I've been trying to look at these budgets and see, you know, is there any factor or how we're arriving at that, and what that rolled up cost would be as we look at the total general fund budget. Robin, I wonder if you could you shed some light on...
I'm not exactly sure I know what you're asking.
The premise is this, is that if we reduce our costs for programs like bowling here, we have reductions of almost $400,000 in general fund expenditures. That translates into increased funding for, you know, medications, for education, mm-hmm. for over and above what was in the governor's budget. And you know, if you I'm wondering how we're arriving at that and how we roll up that cost to understand what the total impact is. I guess maybe the first question would be the DAS assessment. Is that just factored? Is it a factor?
If I understand your question, for example, the governor's budget assumed a certain number from the savings from Merit and COLA. I mean, the governor's budget was built on the assumption that those savings would occur. So the governor estimated what the savings were and then spread those savings to other government services. And it's my understanding, and I'll have to go back and check, the same thing is true of the co-chair's budget with regard to inflation and the DAS and the Attorney General savings that the statewide number was calculated, and though that statewide number was then used to balance the budget overall.
11.2 billion plus has already factored in all of the things that we're now taking out.
I think so.
I believe so. So, and I have to go back. I did some of it.
Was your question to the effect that, let's say, Bowie has so much money for projecting for the assessment to both the Justice Department into to DAS, and how do you figure out how much Bowie needs in terms of its assessment to from DAS, and also its cost to DOJ?
Right.
Was that the question?
Well,
in terms of what is the formula?
Right, and there is a formula. It's a statewide formula. In the case of the Department of Justice assessment, it was spread on a division by division basis for all state agencies. With regard to the DAS assessment, we had a number that the agency had to spread to programs and funds. Again, a lot of this is handled centrally. I'm stuttering a little bit because some portion of the savings, and I can't remember which part because I didn't bring it with me, but some of the savings accrue to the subcommittee, which is a number that can be used to fill holes based on what the subcommittee's preferences are. Most of the major savings were factored in as part of the overall budget development.
And then the purge, there's a cost effect.
That has not been spread yet.
The cost savings effect in the purge.
Right.
So that'll be held out as a global number at the end.
That's my understanding. And there'll be a reconciliation bill that will make all of the adjustments in state agency budgets.
So the budget that we're looking at here, when it says the governor's balanced budget, that was 11.4.
Yes.
Now it's 11.2.
The co-chair's budget.
There are so many budgets.
Right.
I just wanted to add to what I think I hear in terms of line of questioning. I think it was 1989, John, that we had just a series of cases with, and Robert, you might remember this, and it was DHR at the time.
Mercifully, I wasn't here.
I mean, so the cost is spread out across agencies. Otherwise, that one agency could use as much as $400,000 a year in lawsuits because it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of agency. And I know all of us as legislators always thought, man, alive, DOJ sure is costing this agency a lot of money. Well, the dollars are spread across the agencies to better facilitate opportunity for one agency not going totally belly up from that. And so they have to have those attorneys available to do that. One case could cost as much as probably a department almost costs, especially an agency like DHR or Civil Rights Division, something of that nature. So it could be quite expensive.
Anyway, I can get the specific information for you on what assumptions were built into which budgets.
because we have that information. So I will do that for you.
Okay. Any other questions or inquiries? If not, I will. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. Following up on Senator Morris's question, Robin. So when the formula, when we make an adjustment in funding decision, we'd say we're not going to fund line item at 100,000, we're going to fund it at 50. Does the formula take into consideration then adjusting all of those, the DAS number, the DOJ, all those numbers, and effectively then run the formula again and incrementally reduce them even further? Or do those numbers stay the same or go up?
If there are policy option packages that were in the governor's budget that included DAS and DOJ assessments and those kinds of factors, then those adjustments would be made in the policy option packages.
So when we're looking at a budget, let's say it's $1 million budget and DOJ is 2%, $20,000, and we decide, no, we're not going to fund $1 million, we're going to fund $950,000. Does the formula get reworked in that $20,000 that was there for DOJ get reworked and now it's $19,700?
It depends on what you're doing.
Well, because there could be millions and millions of dollars of adjustment by reworking the formulas if we're using standard. Well,
keep in mind that budgets are not approved at a line item level. So if there is a reduction to an agency budget, the agency would make adjustments in how it's going to spend the allocation that's given.
But if we're making a decision saying we're going to fund, and I'm making this up, DOJ at 3%, and that 3% is calculated on a previous total, and now we reduce that, are we incrementally reducing
that? What I'm trying to say is that if you have a budget and you say that that you want to reduce the budget by X amount. Depending on what it is that you are telling the agency not to do. And the reason I say that is if you're talking about special payments or some other kind of reduction, then that would not affect how the funds are spread through the line items within the budget. But if, in fact, you're just taking an unspecified reduction to the agency services and supplies budget, then all categories within that budget would be reduced, including the DAS assessment and the AG assessment, unless there was some reason that that couldn't be done. And that would depend on the type of expenditure.
Senator Morris.
Dense Morris over here. Okay. So all the reductions that we're making in these budgets have already been accounted for in the 11.2.
Not all of the reductions. Let me go back and take a look. There are certain categories, and I'm sorry, I'm just simply not tracking this morning on exactly what they are, but there are certain categories that have already been factored into the budget. I know that, for example, the co-chairs assumed a savings of $52 million from vacancies. They assumed a certain level of savings from the DAS assessment. They assumed a certain level of savings from the Department of Justice assessment reduction. Those are all known numbers, and they were all factored into the development of the budget. There are some other adjustments, and I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly what they are, that are the subcommittee savings they go towards getting at the subcommittee's unspecified cuts is about where we are at this point, which is also factored into the budget development, and I'm trying to track all of that to make sure that we're making the co-chair cuts and that we're getting to our unspecified cuts and to identify any savings that we're coming up with.
The last budget we just passed out was a reduction of $120 million. That's already been accounted for in the co-chair's budget.
Yeah. Okay. We are at this time going to close work session on Senate Bill 5526, and with a tap of the gavel, we will be adjourned.
I took him over that 750.